Coming up on Philosophy Talk...
To all noble and worthy ladies...
The life and thought of Margaret Cavendish.
This present description of a new world was made as an appendix to my observations upon experimental philosophy, and, having some sympathy and coherence with each other, were joined together as two several worlds at their two poles.
Can you do philosophy in poetry, or theater, or utopian fiction?
By this poetical description, you may perceive that my ambition is not only to be empress, but authoress of a whole world.
What would it mean to believe in the radical equality of everything?
What made Cavendish think we're no different from rocks and trees?
She's a very creative and experimental thinker.
Our guest is Karen Detlefsen from the University of Pennsylvania.
Though I cannot be Henry V or Charles II, I will endeavor to be Margaret I.
Margaret Cavendish, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What would it mean to believe in radical equality?
Did Margaret Cavendish really think we're no better than ants, trees, and rocks?
And what about the equality of men and women?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy, and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, it's the next episode in our Wise Women series, generously supported by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're talking about the life and thought of Margaret Cavendish.
Right, so she was Duchess of Newcastle in the 17th century, and a fascinating polymath. She had this radical idea that everything in the universe thinks, even amoebas, rocks, trees, dust.
Yeah, that was incredibly radical for her time. Back then, most philosophers didn't believe that matter could ever think. Not even the matter in my brain.
Right, like Descartes, for example, right, who's writing it around the same time. He said, your soul is a completely different kind of thing from your body. Yet your body moves around in space, but it can't think. Your soul thinks, but it can't move through space because it's not made of matter.
But Cavendish said there was just one kind of thing, matter. She said, whatsoever is not material is no part of nature. And matter is intelligent, sensitive, even rational.
Wait a minute. You're telling me my coffee cup is rational?
Well, it's holding your coffee. Could you do that by yourself? Yeah, I didn't think so.
Okay, Ray, but my mug isn't deciding to hold the coffee. I put it in there and I can pour it out again. I'm the one in control here.
Ah, there's where you're wrong. Cavendish says the mug is deciding to stay there and hold your coffee. And it's deciding to move to your mouth when you drink. You can't move things. They can only move themselves.
So you mean the mug has to want to change? I mean, that's a nice principle for psychotherapy and all, but does it really apply to inanimate objects?
Well, look at you, Mr. High and Mighty Master of the Universe. You know what Cavendish says about you? She says, he would fain be supreme and above all other creatures. She says we love to think we're special, but really, we're no better than anything else, no better than the rest of the matter in the universe.
Well, there's a part of that I really like. I mean, the part where Cavendish says we're no better than ants or bees. She says, I cannot perceive more abilities in man than in the rest of natural creatures. For though he can build a stately house, yet he cannot make a honeycomb. That is just wonderful. But again, does it really apply to my coffee cup? Next thing you'll be telling me is it has feelings.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It cries every time you leave it in the sink and don't wash it. Maybe you should be nicer to the dishes.
I think maybe I'll start by being nicer to my fellow human beings.
Yeah, about that. Cavendish had a lot to tell her contemporaries about how to be nicer to women.
Right. She saw men treating women as inferior beings, capable only of doing housework and being pretty ornaments. We are kept like birds in cages to hop up and down in our houses.
It's kind of heartbreaking. She wrote all these philosophical and scientific treatises, and the men around her just ignored them. She wrote letters about their philosophical ideas, and they didn't write back.
That's true, but in her fiction, she got to live out a very different reality. She has this fantastic science fiction novel, The Blazing World, where the main character becomes an empress and has smart conversations about astronomy and chemistry, and even saves her adoring citizens from an attack.
Yeah, writing those novels was a great way to exercise her own freedom. I love that line in her preface, though I cannot be Henry V, or Charles II, yet I endeavor to be Margaret I.
That is so great. But Ray, I'm still confused about my coffee cup.
Well, I bet our guest can help you understand. It's Karin Detlefsen, professor of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania.
But first, what do today's novelists have to say about Margaret Cavendish? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out. She files this report.
What a vision of loneliness and riot the thought of Margaret Cavendish brings to mind.
It was in Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own that writer Danielle Dudden first encountered Margaret Cavendish.
And she describes her as being like a carnation, I think. No, a cucumber, that's it. That's what's so important.
As if some giant cucumber had spread itself all over the roses and carnations in the garden and choked them to death.
It was such a bizarre and honestly kind of weirdly phallic description of Cavendish.
Years later, Dudden started her PhD and took a class on the poetics and historiography of the 17th century. She got really into 17th century gardens. But everything Dudden wrote kept leading her back to Margaret Cavendish, the Duchess of Newcastle and a prolific writer.
Like, she was in every garden I was writing about.
So Dudden spent about 10 years writing a novel about Cavendish called Margaret the First, a Novel. The book is fiction, drawn from Cavendish's real life. All the excerpts you're going to hear are from Dudden's book, like this one.
For all these fertile inner workings, Margaret was thought plain, couldn't wear yellow, was shy. Yes, seemed younger than her years. Yet Margaret longed for fame. When grown, she would adorn herself like a peacock.
She wrote that stuff about, on the one hand, desiring ambition and fame, and on the other hand, feeling like they were meaningless. You know, she struggled with that desire, I think, and she was notorious in her own era.
These were interesting times.
The King of England was convicted of treason. Then the King of England was dead. It was Tuesday. It was 1649.
While in France, Margaret met William Cavendish, athlete, scholar, and the first Duke of Newcastle. The pair wed in 1645 while in exile in Paris. And while Cavendish had little formal education, she read and read and wrote and wrote. She even wrote her husband's biography. Cavendish loved philosophy. Dudden was intrigued by her thoughts on the French philosopher Descartes.
He thought the universe was like a machine, the body like a clock. He'd once nailed his wife's poodle to a board. He believed nothing could think or feel but man. But how could he know a poodle didn't feel? Or even a magnet? A vase? Now he was gone, and I ate my bread. While one book in the world might be considered an anomaly, two books, it seemed, sounded an alarm. The lady is a fraud. Even if the books were ridiculous, how could a woman speak the language of philosophy at all?
Defending a second book quickly led to a third, Philosophical and Physical Opinions, 1655. In it, I argued all matter can think, a woman, a river, a bird. There is no creature or part of nature without innate sense and reason, I wrote, for observe the way a crystal spreads, or how a flower makes way for its seed. I shared each page with William, often before the ink had dried. It put me at odds, he explained, with the prevailing thought of the day.
How could the world be wound up like a clock? The fictional Cavendish wonders, pulsing, contracting, attracting, and generating infinite forms of knowledge. In 1666, Cavendish published The Blazing World, about a utopian kingdom in another world that could be reached through the North Pole.
The blazing world with its blazing sky and river of liquid crystal, its gowns of alien starstone, its talking bears and spiders. William has told her it's her finest work, and even composed a poem to include.
You conquer death in a perpetual life, and make me famous too in such a wife.
The next year, Margaret became the first woman to attend a meeting at the Royal Society of London, a feat not repeated for centuries.
And then when she got there, she basically didn't say anything.
She'd arrived 20 minutes late, so she sits there still. Hook has finished and the room awaits her reply. But the Duchess only sits, looking into the device. That hat is too much, Pepys thinks. Still, her shape is fine. At last, she lifts her head. What ingenious remark will she make?
Gentlemen,
she says.
I am all admiration.
She rises from her chair.
I am all admiration,
she says again. She nods stiffly, as if wishing them well. She looks to Lord Bronker, who stands, surprised, and leads her to the door.
People call her Mad Madge, but Danielle Dudden wrote her novel with a lot of love and respect for Cavendish.
Margaret wanted the whole house to move 3 feet to the left. It was indescribable what she wanted. She was restless. She wanted to work. She wanted to be 30 people. She wanted to wear a cap of pearls and a coat of bright blue diamonds.
Cavendish wanted to live in many ages and in many brains, and would likely get a kick out of being resurrected in fiction and on the radio. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that really inspiring report, Holly. What a fascinating and brilliant individual. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about Margaret Cavendish.
We're joined now by Karin Detlefsen. She's professor of philosophy and education at the University of Pennsylvania and co-editor of The Routledge Handbook of Women in Early Modern European Philosophy. Karin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Karin, you're an expert on early modern philosophy. How did you get interested in Margaret Cavendish?
Well, when I was a graduate student, I was tucked away in a dusty library at the University of Toronto reading through some of Leibniz's letters, and I came across a line, it was almost a throwaway line in one of those letters, in which he says that his philosophy resembles closer than any other philosophy that of the Countess of Conway, Anne Conway. And I was just stopped in my tracks. I was amazed to see the name of a woman as a philosopher in the 17th century. But I was equally amazed that before that time, I hadn't even asked myself where all the women were. And that got me going on a really big project of trying to see what other women were writing during the 17th century.
So, Karin, one cool thing about Cavendish is that she didn't write only philosophical treatises. She also wrote plays and poems and novels. What made those such a good way for her to engage with philosophical topics?
So I think that Cavendish experiments in a lot of different genres, partly just because she's a very creative and experimental thinker. But I also think that she experiments with different genres and different methods in these genres because it allows her to interrogate philosophical questions that are, for her, really difficult. I'll give you one example, but there are many, many examples. So in one of her plays, a play called Youth's Glory and Death's Banquet, she has a conversation throughout the play between a young woman, Lady Sainsbury, and her parents, mother and father Love, and they're grappling about a question on what it means for women to be free. And we get three really different views in these three different characters. We never get a final answer on what it is for women to be free, but we get three really different views. And I think that she uses this technique in order to demonstrate how hard it is to answer a question about women and women's freedom at a time when women's capacities and their ability to be free was very, very circumscribed.
So what are the options? I'm curious.
So Lady Sainsbury, the young woman, says she doesn't want to get married. She's going to get the best education she can get, better than most men, and certainly as great an education as the best available to men. And then she's going to use this in order to rise in the intellectual ranks and enjoy a life of the mind. Her father is very much in favor of this and encourages her whilst also cautioning her against what might be difficulties along the way. And her mother is absolutely opposed to this. She thinks that this is a recipe for disaster, that Lady Sainsbury is going to be thwarted along the way and only end up being miserable, and that for a woman, the best way to be free is to cultivate womanly activities like embroidery and such and marry well. And this is the best chance at freedom that a woman in her age could have.
So that's a great example of a case where a kind of a dialogue form, a play form, is exploiting the possibilities of getting into a question that you deliberately don't want to answer. Either you can't answer or you kind of want to leave open. But what about science fiction? I mean, she wrote one of the earliest works of science fiction, The Blazing World. Do you have any thoughts on why she chose that genre?
Yeah, I think, and this I think actually can also be said of any form of fiction that she writes. I think a lot of what she's doing in her fiction, and I see this in a lot of women writing in this period, and actually some men too, is trying out hypotheses of what might be the case. So what would be the case if you had a world in which different possibilities for human beings were made available to people? What might be the outcomes of that? It's very interesting social parallel to the scientific exploration of this period. The idea of setting a hypothesis and testing a hypothesis was just emerging in the scientific world, and that got picked up in the social writings as well. Let's set a hypothesis about, you know, what if we had different educational opportunities for women? What might be the case? And then playing out the possibilities in this sort of fictional world. So I think that's one way in which she uses fiction, including in her, you know, her science fiction or her utopian fantasies.
Yeah, so a kind of fiction as thought experiment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Margaret Cavendish with Karin Detlefsen from the University of Pennsylvania.
Are there animals you won't eat because they have feelings like us? Do you wonder whether spiders have feelings too? How about trees and rocks?
Mind, matter, and Margaret Cavendish, along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's time to stop all this gardening.
It's dirty as
Let's call a spade a spade is a spade is a
if
spade.
If Margaret Cavendish is right, does that mean carrot juice is murder? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about Margaret Cavendish with Karin Detlefsen, co-editor of The Routledge Handbook of Women and Early Modern Philosophy.
It's the latest episode in our Wise Women series, which is supported by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. You can find all the episodes in the series at philosophytalk.org/wisewomen.
Got questions about this intriguing 17th century thinker? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and question everything in our library of nearly 600 episodes.
So, Karin, earlier Ray and I were arguing about Cavendish's thoughts on matter. Did she really believe my coffee cup is sentient?
Well, I'm not sure that your coffee cup is sentient for Cavendish, or I think a lot depends upon what you mean by that. It is absolutely true that Cavendish thought that all matter in the world is rational, sensitive, and inanimate, and that these three aspects of matter are thoroughly blended together, such that no piece of matter, no matter how small, doesn't have those three things in it. But what she means by rational and what she means by sensitive is very different than what we might mean by those terms if we're thinking about them from a human point of view.
So what is it for my coffee cup to be rational exactly?
So she has some really, really interesting metaphors that I think are quite helpful in trying to get a grip on this. And one metaphor she has is of how a building gets made. So there are the architects, and they're the ones who sort of think through the plans, get the overall sense of how things are supposed to look in the end, et cetera, et cetera. Then there are the builders. They're the ones who take the material and put the building together in accordance with the plan that the architect has come up with. And then there's the materials out of which the building is built. The architect is like the rational matter. The builders are like the sensitive matter, and the material is like the inanimate matter. And so there's this really functional sense of what she means by rationality. It's the feature of the natural world, whether that be a human or a dog or a fern or a coffee cup, that is lawful and that makes sense in terms of repeated patterns, that accomplishes certain functions like holding coffee, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not like the coffee cup is sitting there thinking, I wish somebody would put more coffee in me or anything like that. It's rather functioning as a thing that holds coffee and that doesn't have coffee flying out into the air or seeping through the matter, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of her way of accounting for regularities and patterns in the world, not just the human world, but the whole world through and through.
It's a super interesting view. One of her lines that I find really interesting is when she says, life and knowledge is in all parts of all creatures. So, you know, no matter how finely you slice up the matter of nature, there's knowledge there. Is this an anticipation of what we're now calling panpsychism, the idea that, you know, everything in the universe has at least a little tiny bit of consciousness?
I think definitely she has been characterized as a panpsychist, and I think that I would be comfortable with thinking about her in that way. I don't know that consciousness is quite the right way to think about it. So I'm not quite sure that she believes that the coffee cup is self-aware, for example, even while it behaves in a way that is very pattern-oriented or in a way that is lawful. What's really interesting about her account of rationality is that it is so expansive. I know what it feels like to be rational as a human, and I know sort of by proxy what it's like for you to be rational as a human. I can kind of guess what it might be like for a chimpanzee to be rational because they're pretty close to us. But there comes a point in time when we just don't understand what it feels like to be rational as something else. And that expansiveness of the nature of rationality is, for me, a really, really stunning feature of her philosophy, and one that gets us to think really differently about all things in the world.
But I like her argument. So you mentioned one of her arguments for this, which is how on earth otherwise could we explain the orderliness of the universe? And there's another one I'd like you to say something about if you're willing to, where Cavendish says, I shall never be able to conceive how senseless and irrational atoms can produce sense and reason. And that sounds like a pretty interesting argument too, this idea, well, look, you know, certainly we know that as human beings we have sense and reason, but we're just made up of atoms. So you have to explain that. And one of the ways she wants to explain it, if I'm understanding her correctly, is by thinking of matter differently, is by thinking of atoms differently. Is that about right?
It is. She did start out in her life as an atomist. That is, she thought everything in the world was made up of little bits that were units unto themselves and couldn't be broken apart. But somewhere along the way, she realized that the world couldn't be made up of things like that because those kinds of things are isolated from one another and you can't get regularity and patterns out of things that are isolated from one another, that can't in some sense communicate from one another. And so she ended up in the camp of what we these days call plenists. That is, the world is just one continuous chunk of matter. And what you are as an individual is a chunk of matter that is relatively stable within yourself in the same way that the coffee cup is a bunch of matter that is relatively stable within itself. But all stable units eventually disintegrate. When we die, our bodies disintegrate and get absorbed into other chunks of matter that themselves may become stable. So that quote that you cite, I think, might be more about you can't get patterns out of atoms. You have to have a plenum that is capable of intra-communication to be able to get patterns and lawfulness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Although I still have some puzzlement about how Cavendish gets patterns even with her plenum. So I guess like the way that I understand a plenum is it's that there's no empty space. There's just like swathes of stuff, all of which has to kind of be touching each other because empty space, she thinks, doesn't make sense. How could you have nothing and have it take up space? But even with her plenum, I'm really confused about how matter communicates with other matter to make patterns. So like I think of like what happens when I lift my coffee cup to my mouth is that my hand grabs the coffee cup, transfers some momentum from itself to the coffee cup. And then I guess like the transfers some coffee from the coffee cup to my mouth. But I take it that's not what Cavendish thinks is happening. What is going on for her?
Yeah, so that gets to the point or the role, the functional role of rationality. Let's talk about it in a way that's more accessible to us. Say I were to say to you, could you please raise your hand? And if you were being lawful and obedient, you would go ahead and you would raise your hand. I'm not going over there and picking up your hand and making it go into the air. I'm not transferring any motion to you, et cetera, et cetera. I'm giving you an idea, and you are picking up that idea, and you're picking it up because you're rational. You can understand what is being asked of you. And then from within yourself, from the power within yourself, what she would call the sensitive matter in you, you're putting your hand up in the air. Something like that is happening between you and the cup. Actually, it's really between you and the hand and then the hand and the cup. Your brain is coming up with the idea of, I want my hand to reach over and pick up the cup. The rational matter in your hand, which is rational in a way that we don't understand because we are bigger than just our hands, but it is responding to that communication in a way. It is reaching out to the cup. And then it's picking up the cup. But it's not that the hand is doing the picking up. The cup is receiving some kind of communicative message through its own rationality, is responding and lifting up. Once again, we can understand what it's like for our human brains to be rational, but all those other forms of rationality in that chain of that causal chain, we don't understand, but we know that it is happening because it happens all the time, and it happens lawfully, and it happens in accordance with patterns. So that, I think, is where she's coming from in the kinds of causal connections that you've just mentioned.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the 17th century writer and thinker Margaret Cavendish, with Karin Detlefsen from the University of Pennsylvania. Now, Karin, I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, chimpanzees. I happen to be a big fan of chimpanzees, and I'm really interested in Cavendish's views about how human beings should relate to the non-human world. She has this nice line, justly, there can be no complaints made against nature nor to nature. So whatever she means by nature in that sentence, she's clearly a fan. And I'm just wondering, okay, if we're all kind of made of the same stuff, and there is, you know, certainly rationality in chimpanzees and other non-human animals, maybe even in plants and trees, what does Cavendish think about the way in which we should relate to the rest of the world?
So I think there's a lot that can be said about this. I'll say a couple of things. And one of them is just to mention a poem that she wrote quite early on in her life, in which she extols the virtues of vegetarianism. Since animals have rationality and they have ways of experiencing the world, being engaged with the world in whatever way of thinking and feeling about the world is relevant to the kind of species that they are, we need to show respect for that and not eat those animals. Now, of course, given that this is true of everything in the world, one, I think, could make the argument that we ought not to eat plants either, we ought not to drink coffee, et cetera, et cetera. She did not go that far, but she did, at least in this one poem, go far enough to say we ought not to eat our fellow animals.
So she had some other stuff to say about how we should treat animals too. Please tell us more.
Yeah, sure. I think one of the really other really cool things that we find in her work is how much we can learn from the natural world by observing the natural world. So, you know, you mentioned ants and bees before, the awesome things that ants can do, the awesome things that bees can do. And she has lots and lots, spiders too. Spiders feature into her discussion. There are lots of examples in which she says, animals in the world can do things that humans can't get anywhere near doing. And we can learn from them in so far as we can appreciate the things that they do. And it's that sort of appreciation of the natural world that also is another super interesting feature of her consideration of the what one might think is the kind of equity between humans and the rest of nature.
Right. So I wonder if you could find some eco-feminist inspiration in this. So one criticism that I think is pretty reasonable of both like Cavendish's fellow Europeans in the Enlightenment and probably like my fellow Americans today is that like they think that nature is this thing to just be exploited for humans. How critical do you think Cavendish is of that view?
So I think her philosophy allows her, and it allows us, to be very critical of that view. She's living at a time and in a place in which exploitation of the natural world really started. The first mines were being created, or people were first mining the earth right around the time that she was writing. And the reason why this was not seen as an assault on the natural world is that the natural world was understood to be just a machine that could be manipulated and taken apart and broken up, et cetera, without doing any damage to anything. Her view of the natural world is starkly different than that. If everything in the natural world is alive, is rational, is sensitive in the very particular ways that they are, then violently breaking them apart is a violation of those things as living, rational, sensitive things. So this respect for nature in and of itself is absolutely something that I think we can find in her philosophy. And we find it also in her writings sometimes as well.
So it's a really beautiful and moving view about a kind of live and let live, try to have a kind of light footprint on the world around you. But I'm wondering how it squares with her thoughts about the way in which human society should organize itself, because that doesn't seem quite as much live and let live. She was a monarchist, if I understand correctly. Pretty similar to Thomas Hobbes. She seemed to think that the best form of human society, the best way to organize it, is to have a single leader, a monarch, that has pretty extensive powers. So how do those two things go together?
So I agree with your reading on her. I think she was a monarchist, a royalist. But I have to mention that there are some folks who read her and read her really, really carefully who believe she probably, in her heart of hearts, was not a royalist, that she was more like a Republican thinker. But what I mean by that is that nothing should be under the arbitrary power of another, and no human should be under the arbitrary power of, for example, a monarch. So I think lots and lots of people, including philosophers, find themselves in conflict about things. I think her philosophy leads more naturally to an egalitarian social structure that is in keeping with the Republican model, even though I agree with you, she was a royalist. But I think that that comes more from her own personal point of view. She was, you know, worked in the royal court. She married Cavendish and fled along with Hobbes during the interregnum because of the attack on royalism. And I think she had a personal investment in royalism, even though I think in some moment she was conflicted about that. And it's that conflict that is picked up often by folks who think that she tends more towards a more egalitarian social structure.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the life and thought of Margaret Cavendish with Karen Detlefsen, co-editor of the Routledge Handbook of Women in Early Modern European Philosophy.
Why are some people's views taken more seriously than others? How can we help those others be heard? What can Cavendish teach us about politics today?
Cavendish and the Contemporary Commons, plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. In a world run by men, what does it take for a good girl to be heard? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Karen Detlefsen from the University of Pennsylvania, and we're thinking about 17th century writer Margaret Cavendish. It's part of our series Wise Women, supported by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
So Karen, before the break, we were talking about egalitarianism versus monarchism. But what about another form of equality, the equality between men and women? What did Cavendish have to say about that?
So again, philosophers love to disagree on things, and you'll get all kinds of views on this. I'll tell you what my view is, which is that she believes that men and women are equal, certainly from the point of view of intellectual capacities, and therefore from the point of view of the sorts of lives that men and women ought to be able to pursue. And this comes from the same direction that her leveling of humans and nature comes from. We're all made up of the same kind of stuff. There's nothing that's fundamentally, constitutionally different in any of us. And this is true of women and men as well.
So a lot of Cavendish's fiction imagines women as having the kind of worldly power that is denied to her in her life and to women around her. What do you think that's telling us about her views of sort of women and men and how they do and could interact?
That's a great question. You know, at the very, very beginning of this segment, folks were talking about Descartes, and Descartes is really, really interesting in this question. He, of course, thought that all human beings are essentially and only a thinking soul, and many, many women of the early modern period took this to be hugely promising for women, because there's nothing bodily about a soul. There's nothing that genders a soul. And so there's really radical equality there. Cavendish is a materialist and opens up the door to potential inequality between men and women that is based in different bodies. So women do have different bodies than men, and that biological difference was often used as a way of explaining why women were inferior to men, or used to justify the belief that women were inferior to men. And she was open to that criticism. I think she uses her fiction in order to express the view that even though there may be differences in the physical makeup of women's and men's bodies, if we were to have social conditions that allowed for everybody to reach their full potential, then we can imagine a world in which everybody does reach their full potential, and that that full potential is in no way gendered.
So I'm a little bit curious about the relationship between this and her psychological egoism, actually. So she's got places where she argues that everybody who does anything does it out of self-interest. And I kind of wonder whether this is a healthy self-respect in a woman who is kind of a little bit being crushed down by her society to keep a hold of something, you know, really important in a human soul.
That's a great question, and it's a feature of Cavendish as an individual that's really, really interesting, and that is her desire to chase glory and fame. She really, really wants to be recognized. She wrote an enormous amount, across great numbers of genres and great numbers of topics. I think all as a part of getting herself and her thinking out there in the world in order to chase fame, in order to be remembered. And I can imagine that that would come from a position of social disadvantage.
And wanting to be heard. This is something you've written about, this idea of what we today call testimonial injustice, the fact that some people's voices are heard and some not. And you've written very persuasively that Cavendish was anticipating that conversation 400 years ago. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I should actually mention that I think Cavendish was not the first to identify this. As you know, I think it goes back as far as Marie de Gournay, if not farther. And Marie de Gournay has this really, really beautiful and pithy moment in her work where she said, you know, the stupidest man can say something and that man will be listened to before the smartest of women is listened to. And that gets to this idea of testimonial injustice, that whether or not a person's knowledge claims are picked up and taken seriously often depends upon features of that person that they cannot be disengaged from, features of their identity that they cannot get rid of. And Cavendish has this too, that as a woman, her knowledge claims will not be taken as seriously as those of a man simply because she is a woman and not because of the quality of the claims of knowledge. And that's found, I think, in many different and interesting ways throughout her work.
So that Du Cornet quote seems depressingly fresh today. I wonder how far you think we've come in combating testimonial injustice since the 17th century.
Yeah, so I'll say a couple of things. First of all, that term, testimonial injustice, really only entered philosophical lexicon in the late 20th century, maybe early 21st century. That it was picked up and named and theorized in the late 20th century is, I think, a really strong testament to how dangerous it is to forget the works of philosophers from across the spectrum. Had we been able to listen to people like Cavendish in the first place and take them seriously, we would not have had to reinvent that wheel, and we might have been able to make greater progress. I do think we have made progress, absolutely. Women are in universities these days, and this was as professors, and that was not the case in Cavendish's time. But one of the really interesting things about contemporary accounts of testimonial injustice is that it expands the categories of individuals who are not listened to well beyond European women. And that expansion project, I think, is really important and interesting.
So that seems to be an area where Cavendish is really ahead of the curve, thinking about testimonial injustice, along with Du Cornet. Another one I'd love to hear from you about is what we might think of as a kind of vicious circle of internalized oppression or something like that. She says that, you know, men claim that women don't have reason. And Cavendish says, we, out of a custom of dejectedness, think so too, which makes us quit all industry towards profitable knowledge, being employed only in loose and petty employment. So if I understand it correctly, she's saying basically the danger is women might internalize that sexism and turn to basically homemaking. And as a result, that just reinforces men's prejudice. They say, well, look at these women. All they're doing is you know, mending and sewing and things like that. Do I have Cavendish right here?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really, really interesting phenomenon that one finds in her prefaces. So I'm thinking about the prefaces that she writes for texts that we recognize today as more sort of standardly philosophical treatises. And some of those treatises have 4, 5, 6, 7 prefaces. And in those prefaces, we get a lot of really interesting framing of the social conditions in which the philosophical treatises were produced. And we get very clear examples of exactly the kind of argument that you've just put forward, that it's really hard, not just for men, but for women too, to be able to hear women's voices and to learn from women and to understand that women have knowledge because of, in the case of women, this internalized sense that they don't have anything to contribute. And in the case of men, having seen that internalized belief manifest in behaviors that don't back up the idea that women have something valuable to contribute to the knowledge space.
And then it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But
yes,
I wanted to ask
exactly.
you about one other thing. There's a line in Cavendish that I couldn't quite wrap my head around because, you know, against the background of what we've been talking about, she seems to recommend at one point that women be, as she says, modest, chaste, temperate, humble, patient, and pious, housewifely, and a few words. And now, is she just sort of being ironic here, or is she just kind of trying to placate a kind of patriarchal public? What's going on in that line?
So I think there's a really interesting phenomenon that shows up in Cavendish. It shows up in lots of women of this period. Mary Estelle is another really, really interesting case. So part of it in testimonial injustice is the incapacity of people to take up the knowledge claims of, in this case, women. And that is the audience that many of these women were writing for. And if you're writing to an audience that cannot hear you, then you have to find ways of speaking that will get your audience to hear you. I think oftentimes Cavendish is using techniques that will get her heard. And to the degree that in contemporary philosophy, we think of philosophy as needing to be precise and clear and non-ambiguous, we fail to see really, really rich philosophy in the 17th century because women couldn't write that way and get listened to. So I think that's a really important lesson that we take away from Cavendish, is that different people write in different ways in order to gain purchase in the intellectual world.
So, Karin, we've heard so many great lessons from Cavendish about testimonial injustice, about the value of irony, about the value of using a variety of genres to explore your imagination. If there was one thing that you wanted our listeners to most take away, what would you nominate?
Well, so Cavendish is a complicated woman, and her desire to chase fame and glory does sit beside something that I think is really, really valuable, and that is this great humility and looking out at the world, at looking at the world's people, at looking at the world's animals, at looking at everything in the world and thinking there's something to be learned from everything in the world. And I think that openness to learning from everything around us is a really, really beautiful and lasting lesson.
Karin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really a really illuminating conversation.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking about Cavendish.
Our guest has been Karin Detlefsen, professor of philosophy and education at the University of Pennsylvania and co-editor of the Routledge Handbook of Women and Early Modern European Philosophy. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
I think I'm just going to go and spend the afternoon reading a bunch of Cavendish's poems.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We'll put links to those and to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and explore our library of nearly 600 episodes.
And be sure to check out all the episodes in our Wise Women series at philosophytalk.org/wisewomen. Now, a man made of matter that moves fast. It's Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Margaret Cavendish, the Duchess of Newcastle, was a shy woman with a secret flamboyance that erupted in her writing and her fashion choices. Self-educated, she grew up around books, with a brother John who became a founding member of the Royal Society. Another brother, Charles, was killed during the Second English Civil War. She became a maid of honor of Queen Henrietta Maria, Queen Mary, married to Charles I until he was beheaded in 1649. During the Queen in exile, she met and married widower William Cavendish, a man many years her senior, former Royalist general in the Civil War, and the first Duke of Newcastle. Though his lands had been seized, apparently he was adept at maintaining a lavish lifestyle through the clever manipulation of creditors. In Paris, via the so-called Cavendish Circle, he dined with luminaries like Descartes, Thomas Hobbes, Ben Jonson, John Dryden. And though she had always written, after a trip to England with her brother-in-law in a frustrating attempt to gain some money from the sale of land they no longer owned, she began writing books, 13 finally in all, before her untimely demise at 50. Poetry, plays, philosophy, natural science, all somewhat at odds with the findings of the Royal Society. She did not hold the microscopic view of nature, for instance, which she believed was just the male gaze distorting reality with lenses. She called microscopes deluding glasses. She took a vitalistic view. All matter had soul, from rocks to kittens. Humans have the most soul, though, having the ability to throw rocks, thus animating them, making us the commanders, the royalty, you might say, of the material world. Beheaded kings and exiles seem to reinforce, if not inspire, her view that the world is made of motion and will. Boldly, she wrote under her own name and sent all her writings to the Royal Society and ilk, hoping to be read and taken seriously. She was not. Her aim, she wrote to a friend, was fame, to regain the status of a royal and to give status to herself as a woman in this male world. To that end, she became well known in England, not only for her odd books, but her singular fashion sense, which incorporated, it seems, mild androgyny in its presentation. She would write letters to any thinker who might listen, asking politely for attention and appear in public in garb of her own devising, all designed to grab and hold attention. She was called a genius in some quarters and considered an eccentric in others. She finally did attain an audience with the Royal Society, an occasion that caused quite a stir. She was followed to the hallowed meeting by a crowd of boys. Samuel Pepys, the observant diarist, was also there. Now, previously he had written about her, quote, "The whole story of this lady is a romance, and all she do is romantic," unquote. Seeing her in the flesh, however, disappointed him. She, quote, "had been a good, comely woman, but her dress so antic and her deportment so ordinary, I do not like her at all," unquote. Ouch. Further, quote, "nor did I hear her say anything that was worth saying," unquote. Now, certainly in the centuries since, she's found her measure of fame, a niche, you might say, in this world. Her most famous work is her proto-science fiction novel, The Blazing World, another world that you can find at the North Pole if you look for it. The heroine is made empress of this blazing world, and Margaret Cavendish puts herself in the book not as empress, but the empress's friend. It's kind of sweet, really. I was reminded of the self-published books from the 20th century with saucers and space beings, some of which led to strip mall churches in Palm Springs with guru gals in flowing robes who channel Venusian spirits, not to mention Nostradamus and Robin Williams. Except she was more allegorical and metaphorical than literal or metaphysical. She believed that all motion was governed by wit, the swiftest motion of the brain. If that's not true, maybe it should be. She brings to mind Madame Blavatsky, Isadora Duncan, Ayn Rand, Phyllis Schlafly, Judith Butler, and yes, even Taylor Swift, who seems both shy and flamboyant to me, and is certainly queen of her blazing world. If Margaret Cavendish had picked up a guitar, wow, she could have been the 17th century Joni Mitchell. We might have had the birth of rock and roll right there, echoing in the abandoned castle halls with broken-hearted boys following their shiny idols down the muddy, broken streets. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2024.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Pedro Jimenez, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KLW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates. Support for this episode and all the episodes in our Wise Women series comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The views expressed
or misexpressed
on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. That conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and question everything in our library of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Look what you just made me do.